Braun, the South was in a time of great turmoil and bloodshed and all the rest. This is a hypothetical, speculative kind of question. Knowing what you know now about the agony of that time, would you have acted differently in the 30s and 40s particularly in the post-war years, in that period from 45 to 50, to seize an opportunity for the South to deal with some of its own problems rather than waiting for some resolution to be imposed from without, as the court did?
Well, you know, the Dixocratic movement didn't come about just because somebody thought of it over a teacup one day. There was plenty of political agitation and forward thrust. Harry Truman, the Civil Rights Commission, up on the shelf here.
On which Frank Porter Graham served?
Yeah.
That 1947?
Yeah. You see,
commission.
I don't think anybody at the time thought that there was backsliding or missed opportunities to move ahead. I mean, I know the spectrum. Somebody thinks that all the time. Other people yell in. But it wasn't a time of lassitude at all. And I don't know, I remember for vocational and avocational reasons both, occasionally I'd go down to some county courthouse in Alabama with some member of the staff of the... I went down to a meeting of county commissioners in some black belt county out of Tuscaloosa. And I had no function there except I was a freeloader going down with some people from the Bureau of Public Administration. But in the conversation, in the discussions with these local people, my opinion was asked about something by one of our staff members. Alec, do you think so? And so I gave whatever opinion was requested. And a minute or two later, one of the local commissioners said, "Now, like that Englishman there said." Oh, good old Chatham County, Georgia, English.
That's funny.
So I think it would be easy to underestimate the political agitation and volatility and vitality during that period. It wasn't, at least in my observation of it and feelings of it, it wasn't a placid period at all, and it wasn't a period with an assured progression at all. It was a period in which the race issue was front and center and just about in everything that I had to do with. Stimulated by World War II, you must never forget World War II. And what it did. I've told you, send these lads overseas to get shot at and so on, and they discover that there are white folks out there who don't know the difference between black folks and white folks.
Yeah, it made a tremendous
difference. Oh, it just changed the whole dynamic. And those feelings, of course, as we know, round in even the most polite and deferential black population, but here these fellows came back and hell, they risked their lives. And so they gave the environment in which a lot of other people who felt these things themselves began to speak up. So the impetus from the black communities became a very important part of this, and that fueled, you know, white courage and incentives and white opposition both. And so I looked on it as a very vigorous period. And
even during the time when you were in the field for the Key Project,
oh yeah,
you felt that.
Oh yeah, you know, Key and I concluded right off the bat, we saw that there's no way I could conduct interviews, or Don Strong, who did it in two states, conduct interviews with the 1940s version of this recording machine here. The whole assumption underlying our interview was that we could learn some things from the interviews we couldn't learn otherwise. And that meant some technical things. We could get some election results or something that weren't otherwise published. But the main point was that we could get attitudes, opinions, and some facts from the interviewee that we couldn't get otherwise. Now, that depended on establishing a rapport and confidence. And that's why there was nobody from Minnesota who was going around interviewing, or Maine.
Did you do this with a notepad and a pencil?
No, sir. No,
sir. You didn't even take notes?
No, sir.
No tape recorder?
Not until I got out to that car 10 miles down the road.
No tape recorder, no notepad.
No.
You just talked and listened.
Yeah.
And then made notes. That's incredible.
Well, the first step, of course, is what are you going to talk to this fellow about? And when you decide on that, then what are you going to try to find out? And so, you know, it would vary with the subject and the interview and the person and so on. And if you just ran into somebody on the street, a former governor of Arkansas, as I did once, go from there. I had no time to prepare. But I memorized all that agenda in advance. But then the main thing after that was very important. You don't want to wind up with this lot of stuff that you don't want to do. The other thing was memorizing all everything that was said. And I was as conscious as anybody could be of the frailty of the human memory. You know, it's you've got to watch it. But I would race to do one of two things. Make notes. Stop under a pine tree, really, by the highway.
Oh, yeah, sure. I've done it many a time.
I would make the notes. Or, if I were in a city and could go back to my hotel room, dictate, you'd always have to have a few notes to guide you, but dictate the whole thing. But sometimes I've, in effect, written out the whole interview under a pine tree, then go back and dictate. And
how many of those do you suppose you did?
How many interviews?
Uh-huh.
Well, I think it's... 576.
500, over 500 interviews?
I guess I've included the ones that Strong did. Let me see. 538 of them in sessions averaging 70 minutes each. Now, 538. Strong would have done about, let's see, 9 in the 54 is what, 6?
6.
60. That's about right per state, but Strong didn't do as many as I did. So he did two states, so I probably did about 450.
You did seven of the nine states.
Yeah.
And then, that's incredible, Chancellor.
Part of it, you do what you have to do, and the whole climate and so forth was such, and it was a real incentive. And of course, I thought the undertaking was very important, and I had all the reasons for wanting to do my part of it well. And I thought all those things. And it's easier when you're younger to do that than it is when you're older.
Yeah. Still in all, that's quite a feat.
And I think I worked hard at... recalling accurately. Now, anybody would be a jackass to say that he recalled everything accurately about anything,
right.
But I've never found later a statement that I felt I had to correct.
Really a major error.
Yeah, that I felt I had to correct. That doesn't mean the answer in there.
Yeah, but... your mention of the Truman Civil Rights Committee reminds me that, as I said, Frank Graham and Dorothy Tilley from Atlanta, from the Southern Regional Council, were the two Southerners on that commission, which was appointed in 46 and issued its report in November 47. And that's the first time the federal government went on record as saying that segregation was an evil that needed to be eradicated from American life. 1947. And so 7 more years until Brown. And yet, one of the astonishing things to me in my conversations with so many people now on this project I'm working on is how many people have said to me, when Brown came, when I heard about Brown, I was shocked. I truly was shocked. I did not believe this could happen. They were either elated or they were outraged. It depends on who I was talking to, but they were shocked. They could not believe that this had happened. And yet, you go all the way back into the mid-30s and begin to pick up court decisions in the federal courts that were opening institutions or buses or wiping out restrictive covenants or allowing people to serve on juries and so forth and so on, that gradually along the line the courts had been chipping away at Plessy v. Ferguson. And then the federal government through the executive branch had taken this very forthright stand, so much so that it had driven half the Southern Democrats into a third party in 48. And yet, still, people could not believe it. And I'm left to conclude that Brown was almost the whole race issue to people in the South was just, it was simply an unthinkable thought. It was just something that could not be dealt with. And maybe in spite of the fact that it seems in retrospect that we could have done something voluntarily in the 40s after the war, in truth, probably things moved as fast as they could have, and that we reached Brown about as quickly as we could have, and reached the black public protests that led to the civil rights laws about as quickly as we could.
It's almost a self-defining situation, which means that what you said is correct. It's about as quickly as we could have. That's almost the necessary conclusion, given the dynamics that were working. You could say, well, now if everybody had gone to bed one night and awakened with a Christian spirit, that we could have moved faster, but or wouldn't have had to move at all, because it would have been done. But I've thought that I've thought from time to time about this. I think there's just no way that you can have that kind of social evolution without a lot of turmoil. And the other thing that seems to me crucial to remember is it takes a lot of cooks to make the broth. That is, everybody can't be a Frank Graham, not only because they don't have personal politics, but the society needs the red radical out there. The dumb, well-meaning fellow out there. The man in the bank who's going to do what he can within the structure of opportunities open to him, the interest group representative who's going to put his oar in when he can, the newspaper editors, of course, who, when they're secure in the job, have a much easier and better opportunity. We always used to applaud the Southern press, my God,
yeah.
Much more so than we have done in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
All the papers seem to have gone down the drain almost. But then, you know, my God, Birmingham News, the Tennessee, and the Journal, and papers all around the South had taken courageous editorial stands. It just takes a lot of different, it's not only because the Lord made us this way, but a lot of different people doing a lot of different things contribute to any great social movement,
right,
and achievement. And a lot of different people doing a lot of different things contribute to the opposition also.
And so it inevitably takes time for these things to work their way out.
And yeah, I think so.
We probably couldn't have moved it any quicker.
I've thought about Vanderbilt a lot, of course, in all this. I could give you a whole list of people who, of course, thought I was taking the institution to hell, you know. And a big part of the task, of course, was to avoid being unnecessarily vulnerable to those who would oppose what one thinks is a good thing to do. You really have to choose your time and place for things. But I've thought, because I knew and admired Mr. Graham so well. Frank Graham was what he was from the time he was a student. So North Carolina had him. These people over here, when they took Branscombe, they took a pig and a poke, in a way. When they took me, they took a pig and a poke. But they'd taken anybody, really, took a pig and a poke. And you never could forget that, because you didn't have any constituency except this constituency. So Branscombe, I thought he did a remarkable job in leading the institution as fast as he did. And he got into a problem about that Lawson episode, but he really had on this very sensitive matter, a very constructive leadership of the institution, in my belief. And it's hard as hell, especially at a place like Vanderbilt. You know, we work like the devil to get black students and so on, and we hard together.
Yeah.
Hard together.
Right.
And so the only point of all of that is that there's a division of labor, I guess. And somebody like Frank Graham plays his part, somebody like Will Alexander plays his part. Somebody like these Southern Conference Human Welfare people play their part.
Mm-hmm.
Southern Regional Council people there play their part. The academicians, the Howard Odoms, play their part. And on the other side, of course, there's the other sides of the political issues, people doing comparable things in contrast. All of that means, all that is pertinent to, I think, I guess, in supporting, you know, the hypothesis that it's hard to see how things could have moved more quickly given the human beings that the present to be worked with.
Yeah. A couple of things that I found in my notes that I forgot to ask you about the time when you were a student there. In 38, but I think after you had left, Franklin Roosevelt came to the campus to speak. I believe it was in the fall.
December the 5th.
December, after the election campaign that year, when he
came to speak for the Carolina Political Union.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Is that
the major effort in my year, 37-38, was to get Franklin Roosevelt to the campus. And I went up to the White House a couple of times, and we had Frank McNinch, who was the chairman of the Federal Communications Committee, about from Charlotte appointment to Roosevelt. To writing Jim Farley had spoken on the CPU. on the campus and appealed to Mr. Farley. And in the spring, I guess, I had a letter from Mr. Farley saying the president will come. You know, Farley used that green ink always. Will come to the campus next fall. And so that was kind of a legacy that I left. And then my successor followed that up, and he did come. So yeah. December 3rd, I went down from New York.
For the occasion.
Yeah. Yeah. Rain like the devil. We had to speak in the gymnasium. Mm-hmm. We planned it. I mean, I think they had planned it. I had always envisioned speaking in the stadium, but rain, we spoke in the gymnasium. Yeah.
Did Eleanor ever come?
Came to Chapel Hill, yes. More than once. In fact, once when she came, after I was on the faculty there, she asked after her speech if someone would take her out to Will Alexander.
She wanted to go see
him. And I was not alone on this. And she went out there and Will wasn't there, so she missed him. I thought, fine. And I said to this person who was saying, why Will, don't you telephone him?
Yeah.
Tell him, you know, my God.
Yeah.
Well, she was very fond of him. And he appreciated that enormously.
Yeah.
Yeah. I met her along the way in various places. And she came to Chapel Hill, I don't know, must have been 3 or 4 times at least over the years.
She was quite a remarkable lady.
Oh, yeah, extraordinary. Extraordinary.
Another thing that happened that I neglected to ask you about, there was a big cheating ring. A bunch of students were expelled.
36, yeah.
In 36? What do you recall about that?
Well, it's a big cheating ring, and Jack Poole's president student body was caught up in it. And it was just what it was. It was a big thing on the campus at the time.
A lot of people expelled.
Yeah, I can't. The answer is yes, but I don't know how many, and I don't know the conditions, whether they came back or not. But you see, it was a great test of the honor system, and Mr. Graham was a great advocate of the honor system. And this was a hell of a thing to do, you know, in the day, and people shouldn't have been cheating at any time. But it was an awful thing. But it was exposed, the system survived it. And Poole, the president of the student body, God, he should have known better than that. He got kicked out, I guess.
He was one of the ones expelled.
Yeah, as I recall it, he came back. I'm sure he was.
Mm-hmm.
But the honor system was serious there. I remember my sophomore year, I guess it was, I reported 2 students. They were expelled from the university, went through to the honor council. Somebody said, well, hell, it's their business, not yours. Well, that's not, that wasn't the climate.
I've
got a 1 o'clock.
Yeah,
over to do my semi-annual eye exam.
Yeah, I think we've covered it.
Have we done all of you?
Yeah, there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about, and that was Charlie Jones and the Presbyterian Church,
mm-hmm.
and that trouble he got in there across the street from the campus.
I knew Charlie, but I didn't know him well, and I'm not a good authority on.
Uh-huh.
On him, I don't have much to contribute to that.
Yeah.
Charlie, I would not be reluctant to, I just don't.
Yeah, know. Right. We've covered it, Chancellor.
Have
and I feel absolutely elated. As I knew you would, you have moved precisely to answer and stop, and I've gone on to ask the questions, and if anything, I've talked too much, but you've certainly...
Well, if when you are reviewing it, if there's anything else we ought to explore further, don't hesitate to give me a ring.
All right.